I've essentially never suffered rejection as an artist ever in my life before. And it absolutely destroyed me. Like I had an actual nervous breakdown, like, and like a proper actual debilitating depression that lasted, you know, years. But at the same time, you know, we had to get the record finished.
Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of Attention Engineer. Kid, a music producer, songwriter, and solo artist making music as Penfriend and beaming into your ears from my studio, The Launchpad, in Bristol. Find me around the internet at Penfriend Rocks. Thanks for joining me today as I continue my mission to encourage creativity in every listener by sharing conversations with some of the artists I admire the most. Hello from a rainy afternoon in Bristol. I've been having a bit of a blue day, to be honest, so I decided to put my cosy dressing gown on after lunch. And so right now I'm tucked in under my gigantic leopard print blanket with a massive mug of steaming hot Pukka Revitalize tea. It's my new favourite. And no, they're not a sponsor. I don't have any sponsors, I just really like this tea. It feels fancy. In this episode, I talk to songwriter and human, David Ford. His journey through the many worlds of the modern music industry has not always been an easy one to navigate. A succession of record labels, seduced by his talents, have, in turn, attempted to sell him as a pop star, a protest singer, an indie hipster, a balladeer, and a blues man. In reality, he might be all of these things, and none of the above. It's complicated. As well as playing sold-out headline shows on both sides of the Atlantic, he has supported artists such as Elvis Costello and Alan Toussaint, Ray LaMontagne, Amy Mann, Sarah Bareilles, Gomez, Aqualung, Richard Ashcroft, Suzanne Vega, Augustana, Ingrid Michaelson, and Jacob Dylan. We talked about David's brush with the music industry via his first band Easy World and subsequent solo project, and how he survived a breakdown to create a thriving independent career as a lone wolf figure. Why pumping content into the world isn't beneficial for popular music and song as an art form, and why we shouldn't judge artists on the quality of their accountancy. I also quizzed David on his brilliant song State of the Union. He kindly broke it down for us, and I accepted a songwriting challenge. Get comfy, friend. Here's my conversation with David Ford. Well, hello, David Ford. How are you today?
I'm all right. I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm okay. I'm trying to get my head around and remember the fact that this episode will go out in January.
Okay.
So we can talk about things now, obviously. We're not going to pretend it's already January. That would be weird because in this day and age, who knows what could have happened by then? No idea.
Nothing is going to have changed between now and January. We have a very slow moving news year.
How has 2020 been for you?
It's been weird. Am I allowed to use dirty language on here?
Oh, like, please do.
Yeah, I was just checking because when you ask me how 2020 is, the first thing that comes to mind is sort of, you know, a language not fit for the dinner table. But I'll ease into that. It's been a strange year. Let's face it. It's been an odd year, but I've got to say it's not been, you know, it's not been a trial. It's been interesting for me personally. Obviously, you know, I'm in a very privileged position in that I've not been unwell. Nobody who I know has suffered overly as a result of COVID. And so therefore, from that very privileged position, it's been sort of more kind of interesting and educational on a sort of philosophical level, really, about humanity and what it means to be human and how we interact with each other and all questions like that sort of came up in the very early days of lockdown. I found myself thinking this could be, you know, obviously aside from the great tragedy that's unfolding, this could be an incredible time for humanity. We could come out the other side of this with a renewed understanding and you know, love for our fellow human. And then a couple of months after that, now it's we're just going to come out this sort of kind of shittier than we were before, and the rich people are going to be richer and the poor people are going to be poorer, and ultimately, you know, the people who are least in a position to build it back up again are the ones who are going to have to pay for it. So, you know, that optimism lasted, you know, an afternoon. But it was a lovely afternoon.
I shared that optimism, and I really enjoyed the fact that, because I'm normally the person who, I've got a couple of dogs and I walk them around the block all the time, obviously, and I'm always saying hi and smiling to people because I think it's weirder not to. I've always been that person. And usually people just be like, oh, okay. Sometimes they smile back and it's fine. And then when lockdown started, everyone started smiling back. And I just felt like that's so nice. Oh, yeah. Good, we can have this like real community feel in the small part of Bristol I live in. And then a few months later, it's just like nothing again. It's just all the shutters have gone down in people's faces.
Yeah.
It's just this kind of grim kind of grinding through this situation, which I also feel. So yeah, it's definitely, there was a sort of buoyant bit, and then so much now.
Well, I think to start with, there was this naive idea that it would be a few weeks, you know, we'd do this lockdown, and then like a month later, hey, everything's back to normal again. It's gone, you know.
Yeah, we're going into hopefully a more hopeful year. How do you feel about 2021 at the moment? In December 2020,
I refuse to even consider 2021. It's so far away. Who knows what's going to happen between now and then? We could be living on the moon by then.
We could be. Would you like that? Is that a goal of yours in life?
Yeah. I don't know. What's the weather like?
Good question. Hopefully something we could always complain about, because that's what British people love to do.
Yeah. Oh, not much atmosphere, is there? Mm. The gravity's a bit weak.
I prefer his first album. Speaking of which, how's music making going for you? What stage are you at in album out, album not out, album being made?
Well, I don't really know. I feel so old in this... in this realm of making music, I've got to the point where I make records and I just forget to release them because I don't have a label or anything, and I don't have management or anything. I'm just sort of entirely on my own. So for me, the fun part is always writing the songs and making the records, and then when that's done, I go, oh, that was great fun. Let's do another one. And so I'm actually at a position now where I've spent the last couple of days doing admin things, which is the most boring part of being a independent musician, is having to like fill in all these online forms with these various different companies with various different acronyms. So I've been doing the PPL and the PRS and the MCPS and then all that nonsense. And I don't know what I'm doing. I've no idea if I'm doing it correctly. Anyway, I'm hopefully going to answer your question eventually. I recorded an album a year ago, which still isn't out yet, just because I sort of, like I said, I forgot to do it. And then I've been recording constantly throughout lockdown. So there's probably about another album's worth of stuff to put out there. And I have a live album from a tour I did in 2019, which, might come out at some point. So I'm sitting on all these records, and at the same time, that there's all these other projects that I just want to get started with writing and recording. So I might never release any of it. It might just be just there in my own private catalogue. But essentially, I'm trying to work my way through the backlog and actually doing the boring stuff of putting records out.
Yeah, I've spent the morning doing the boring stuff of putting records out, and at least one day last week. So I feel all of that. Yeah, I'm completely independent as well. So yeah, and every time I have to register songs with PRS and PPL and all that other stuff, I feel like I'm just guessing again and just crossing my fingers and hoping that it works. And I'll probably never know if it has or hasn't, because it's not like loads of money comes in later on for royalties. Yeah. So it's hard to tell.
Or maybe it does, and maybe someone else is getting it, or it's just going into a pot.
That other pesky Laura kid who signed up her stuff properly and linked to me. Yeah, maybe. Well, that's good to have a load of stuff in the bag. That's really good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I say, it was the most fun thing was making records. I love it. It's like the worst thing about making records is releasing them. And well, even worse than that is promoting them, which is why I don't bother doing that at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that, because I've got the sense of lots of things I've read about you over the years, especially because I know you've written a book, which unfortunately I haven't read yet, but I've got it.
I'll send you a copy.
Oh, thanks. So yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that aspect of it, because there are lots of different paths we can choose as independent artists. And yours is clearly working because you're able to keep making records, and, you know, you can put them out or not put them out, then it's up to you, which is nice.
Yeah, as I see fit.
Yeah. So yeah, I've read some stuff about how you're not massively into social media, but you still like this, you know, touring and the word of mouth kind of spreading of your music. Yeah. So can you talk a bit about that, about what kinds of decisions you've made and about how you want to carry yourself in the world?
Sure. Well, I mean, I was both fortunate and unfortunate to have got my start at kind of the back end of the old model of the music industry, like, you know,
yeah,
record labels signing bands, putting records out, and back then the idea of or to me anyway, the way I interpreted it was, it's the job of the record label to market your record, and it's the job of the artist to do artistic things, and if you get involved in the marketing side of things, if you even think about it, then that makes you a horrific sellout, and you're not worthy of the term artist,
right?
Which was great back in the day when you'd get signed by a record label, they'd give you a bit of money, and then that's the money you live off. So you don't even have to worry about trying to sell records, because that's, you know, or sell tickets, and so you don't try and do anything to promote anything you ever do. That's up to somebody else to do the job, and it kind of sounds ridiculous now, but it was a blissful time when the only thing I had to think about was writing songs, making records, trying to put on the best show I possibly could, and that was it. And so when I found myself, you know, getting too old to be young and attractive as a proposition for the music industry, and essentially left out on my own, I still couldn't get my head around the idea that I was expected to give any consideration to the promotional side of what I do. It still feels to me like something that's truly kind of grubby and sordid. And like, if ever I even so much as find myself writing a tweet saying, I've got a new album out, I was like, I hate myself. Like, I've just been to a hooker or something. It's like, I feel dirty. And I'm not saying that's a virtuous attitude. That's just how it's been for me. And I can't seem to get my head around the idea that self-promotion is anything other than disgusting. And so yeah, consequently, so the reason I say I was lucky to have started when that was the case is that one of the advantages you got from being with a record label at the back end of the 90s and early parts of the 21st century, rather, is they would throw a decent amount of money at promoting your band. And so my old band were able to tour and release records and have them, you know, lightly promoted, but in such a way that we were able to gain an audience.
Mm.
And then essentially since then it's just been a case of tending to that audience, but not by being their friend, God no, by hopefully maintaining a very high quality output of music, because that is how I perceive, that's what I perceive my job to be, and kind of the extent of my job is being the best, you know, artist I possibly can be, and the fact that I'm a lousy you know, businessman should be beside the point.
Well, it is unrealistic to expect artists to be able to do everything at a really high quality. It's too much for one person, like all yeah, those skills and the time it takes to do all of the stuff. I mean, I yeah, find it to be quite a fun challenge and a bit of a puzzle, like the ways of getting my music out into the world on a good day when I've, you know, had decent sleep and I'm feeling positive about it all. Yeah. And then on other days, I'm just like, yeah, why am I not a marketing person, you know, expected to do this really, really well, and if I don't, then I basically can't live off this music, you know, if I do it badly. That's a lot of pressure. And so the idea that there could be, you know, groups of people who are really, really good at that stuff, i.e. labels or whatever, you know, taking care of that and doing it really well for artists, that's a lovely idea. But
oh, I never said they did it well.
Well, this is what I was getting at, which is like that most of the stories I've heard have been horror stories of where, you know, the labels actually aren't doing that job very well. They're actually not very good at it. And then you're only getting 18% or something of the profits after you've recouped their money. And there's all this kind of like ridiculous percentages of percentages sharing. And
yeah, the other thing to remember with this old model of the music industry is that recouping is like no one ever recoups. Like you don't even consider that that's going to happen. If your label gives you an advance, that you just have to presume that's all the money you're ever going to get. And that's how it was for us. So I didn't even ask what percentage we were on. I don't know. It never even occurred to me that there might be some sort of, you know, future income. And it's sort of, and I never knew what we got paid for gigs. I just didn't ask. I had this real sort of don't ask, don't tell thing, which again is really hard to get out of the hang of it. I really struggle to even remember sometimes to ask to get paid for things because it, and again, this is such a luxury position in that, you know, people do pay for the work that I do. And I'm very grateful that that's the case, but it has allowed me to be incredibly slack and quite blasé in the whole asking for money side of things.
Yeah. But that's another really awkward thing. I often forget to ask for my fee at the end of the night. And I wonder if it's my brain just going, this is so awkward. Why should I have to go and ask for it? Like, can't they just bring it? Like, they know I've played. They know there's an amount agreed. And I have to go, please, can I have my money now? And then go and stand in an office, you know, and then pack up my stuff and then get in the car. And it's just like the parts of the job that are awful. And again, yes, from a privileged position, aren't I lucky to play my music, et cetera, et cetera. But still, it's like, come on, why do I have to go and ask for an envelope of not very much cash at the end of the night? Can you not just pay me? You know, I hear all that.
I did a tour in the US a few years ago, and I pretty much every night, the first thing I do in the morning after a show is I get up in my crappy motel and I have to fire off an email to the promoter from last night saying forgot to get paid last night, could anyway you could just like send me a check or something, because touring in America is so much fun, you know. I would do the gig and it would just be like, that was so much fun, let's pack the van, let's go get a pizza, and then you're there having a pizza going, hang on, how am I gonna pay for this?
Oops.
Yeah.
What about I don't know if you've had to do soulless support slots, by which I don't mean all support slots are soulless, but I mean the ones where you're not quite matching with the audience and they're not really interested, and then you stand at the merch on your own waiting for people to hopefully come and say hi, trying not to look like you care that they're not coming over, and then when the headliner comes over and everyone just like queues in front of you to get to their stuff, and it's just like this horrible kind of like, where do you put your eyes, where do you look, what expression to have on your face? Because that's one of the things I really do not miss about not being able to gig at the moment, is that those kinds of things.
Well, again, I'm old enough to remember a time when I were a lad. Again, like the idea of the artist going standing at the merch table and meeting people it's just so bizarre to me because you know, and we're not talking that long ago. I'm not that old, but. Yeah, so in 2001, when my band did our first, you know, proper grown up tour in proper venues, the idea that you would wait at the merch stand after the show and meet people is abhorrent, because they're supposed to think you're, you know, as soon as you walk off stage, you leave the building and you're instantly, you know, in a hot tub drinking champagne, and that's the. The mystique and the mystery
in Canterbury
of,
or Exeter,
all
those places.
yeah,
of course.
And I still sort of feel like that. If I went to go and see someone, you know, someone who I really love and admire, the last thing I'd want is for them to come along and, you know, want to meet me after the gig. It's like, haven't you got something better to do with your time? So the thing for me is like I'm rarely to be found at the merch thing, because again the idea that I am, you know, they're personally trying to sell my wares. It's like, that's not what we're here. I'm not here to sell you things.
Yeah.
We're here to share a musical moment. Like, you know, and then at the end of it, please go home.
So I can enjoy my hot tub in peace.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, before we started recording, I informed you that my very old band that I'm not proud of, I'm not going to talk about at any length. No, we supported you in Exeter a million years ago. And I just assumed, because I was supporting a band I'd heard of, that you must all be really famous and that. So it obviously was working, this sort of the way you were carrying yourself, because I bought into that completely.
Well, but it does go on, though. There are still people who for some reason think that I'm famous, and that if I go to do my shopping at Sainsbury's, then I'll have to, you know, be stopped like five or six times by people wanting my autograph. It's right. Absolutely. I honestly don't think I've ever been sort of recognised anywhere ever in my entire life as being a famous person.
Yeah.
But there is this strange, thing that this quirk of the human mind, where I think we all on some level expect everybody else to know the things that we know and to appreciate on a same level the things that we appreciate. So if there's somebody who has all my records and thinks that I'm really great, they will just to presume that everyone else in the whole world also has heard of me and thinks that I'm great. And so in their mind, I am a famous international musician. And the international thing is important, because what I find is once I started playing in America, people in the UK just presumed I was huge in America.
And of course,
when I go to America, I'm a foreigner. And so you have this sort of, this foreign mystique, and they think that my accent is interesting. Mm-hmm. And so they presume that I'm a big star in Britain, who's so big that Britain's borders could not contain my genius. And so now I'm spreading the word overseas. And so, once you're working in multiple territories, then there is this sort of presumption that in the other place, you're a really big deal, mm-hmm. which, you know, again, helps to fuel this idea of actually being quite famous, even when one is absolutely not.
And is being famous something you ever considered trying to be as a young boy, thinking I want to do music one day? Was that ever a goal for you?
I'd like to say no. I don't really remember when I was very young, but it certainly doesn't feel like that was ever the point. Like, I mean, when I was young, then being in a band was just seemed like the coolest thing to do. Like playing a guitar, I would. You know, even as a really small kid, like before I even sort of thought about trying to do it myself, like someone playing a guitar and singing songs, it's like the coolest thing, like unbelievably cool. And so when I took up playing music and started a band and things, I'm sure for me the purpose was always like just the doing of it. Like it was. It's just so amazing. And so I don't know what anyone thinks of me and the thing that I'm doing, but it just feels so incredibly fucking cool. Like, you know, making music, like singing songs that I have written myself. And it's still like, you know, like I say, I've not had a job in 20 years, which feels incredibly fortunate, especially given the, you know, the state of the music business and my unwillingness to engage with it. But, you know, I still feel like a giddy child in just how wonderful it is that I get to do this all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think that's still the drive, far more than ever being famous. Cause I mean, to be honest, I've sort of almost gone out of my way not to be famous whenever the opportunity has arisen. So clearly there's something about it that I guess doesn't appeal.
Yeah, none of that appeals to me at all. The idea that you wouldn't be able to go about your business without a load of fuss just seems like a nightmare. And that's not, I make music because I want to make music, not because I want people to think I'm great for making music. It's just the part where you need the music to pay for you to make more music is the bit that is sort of the puzzle there a bit for me.
Yeah, I mean, but that in itself is a tricky thing also. I always sort of take exception when people say to me, the most important thing is that you're earning a living out of music. And I want to slap them around the head and say, no, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that music is getting made and that I'm enjoying it and that I feel inspired and creative. And it's like, if the bills need paying, I'll get a job. You know, that's not why you do it. And it's not important that side of things gets done, that, you know, that music is monetized is the least important part of music. And I think it's, for me, that has to be, you know, like a central ethos to making music for me personally, because otherwise I feel like I worry that it would kind of compromise my independence or my, you know, I don't know, use an awful word like creativity, or even worse word like spirit, or
well, yeah, because yeah, you're just trading one job you might not want to do for another job you might not want to do, and the music has to be the thing that's protected, I think, and that the joy of creating things. I've only been a full-time musician making my own stuff for 2 years. And before that, I had a load of different freelance career stuff going on. Lots of different, things I would do for clients, photography, video, all sorts of bits and bobs. And I was always really open about that, especially online, because I really think it's weird to try and act like you're a full-time musician and everything's going brilliantly, because, I mean, if it is, that's great. But if it isn't, and you're just sort of lying about it, then all the other musicians who probably have part-time, if not full-time jobs, feel inadequate and feel like they're not doing it right. And like you say, it doesn't matter. If you need to pay your bills however you can pay your bills, and then make the music you want to make. I will only ever make the music I want to make. If I can do it full-time, I'd love to. I'd love to keep doing that. But yeah, absolutely. It can't be to spec or to, like, I don't know, to try and impress these random people you don't even know, to try and sell more or anything.
Yeah,
not at all. Ugh, horrible.
And it seems strange that people would that you would judge the quality or the value of an artist based on, you know, how they pay their bills. It's like,
yeah,
surely the whole point is like, here is the thing that I have made. Judge that. Don't judge me as you know, how I run my financial game. It's like you get to that point, and we're essentially judging artists on the quality of their accountancy. It's a very strange metric to use when clearly the thing you should judge is the thing that they make.
Absolutely. And after gigs, people would often say, "Oh, do you do this full time?" And then if I said, "No, I do this, you know, part time, and I do some other stuff," they seemed kind of disappointed.
Yeah,
like, I should like this less, maybe, because you're not doing it. This isn't your full time job. Mm. We're like, well, sorry, it's just the truth. And I always want to tell the truth.
But there are so many reasons. There are so many reasons why that might be the case. You might not want to. You might have a job that you absolutely love doing.
Mm, yeah.
You know, that affords you enough time on the side to make music. Or you might live in London where you can't possibly pay your rent.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're selling millions of records. I mean, on that front, I live in Eastbourne, which is, you know, one of the more inexpensive parts of the south of England, where, you know, housing is relatively inexpensive, and so I can sell as few records as I do and still, you know, not have to have a day job. But if I lived in Bristol, for example, you know, I wouldn't be able to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for me, it was coming to Bristol from London was brilliant, because it was basically halving the price of everything. And then I felt I could, you know, I could definitely make more music and do more stuff, and I work towards where I am now.
Oh, move to Eastbourne. You can live like a king. but Bristol's lovely. I'm a big fan of Bristol.
It's great.
Yeah.
I love it. Haven't seen much of it this year, but I know it's still there.
You've seen a lot more than I have.
Yes. My local streets are looking great.
Yeah.
Just the local neighbourhood. So I'm interested in asking you about missions. If you have a mission for your solo career, so post Easy World.
Right.
And I know you wrote a book that came out in 2011, which I'm sure covers this. But even now, obviously, that's also quite a long time ago.
Yeah, it's 10 years ago the book came out. Yeah.
One, are you thinking of updating the book in any way? And two, what's the mission that you have for your solo career at the moment?
Well, firstly, the one about the book, I've dropped the ball on that, because it was always meant to, I was meant to do the update, should have been written by now, really, because the first one was to mark my first 10 years in the music industry after I quit my day job to be a musician. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, since there's been another 10 years gone past, I may as well, you know, I should really write the next 10 years. But I was sort of, I was waiting for something interesting to happen to sort of close it out. And I know that sounds stupid. That sounds stupid in light of this being such a kind of bizarre and momentous year. But I don't really know that makes a pleasing conclusion for you know, for the story of my decade. So, you know, it's all about me, and this COVID, it's significant, but like it's not really providing good narrative, you know, insofar as my story arc goes. So I was sort of hoping that something amazing would happen, like, you know, I'd win a Grammy, or you know, I'd get shot in the leg or something, you know, something significant and life-changing might happen that would give me a good curtain closer. But no, I think I might have to do one of those endings like you get in an indie movie where just nothing really happens and the film stops.
Well, that's life though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, that is life. But you know, who wants to read about life? give me the fairy story every day. As for my mission, I don't have a mission other than I want to, for me, it's really important to keep improving and to keep my standards unimpeachably high as far as my intentions as a musician. And you know, I'm still so excited to come to this garage every day where I am and make music and write songs and try and get better at doing all of that. And there's so much to learn and to improve, you know, even having done it for this long. I think that's all my mission is, really. It's not about how anything is received or the level of success it has. It's just, for me, it's about seeing if I can do something next that's better than the thing I did last.
And do you see yourself as someone who's going to keep producing music on and on in your life?
Yeah, I don't think I have a choice, quite frankly. It's you know, I mean, writing songs is something that I do, you know, I do accidentally for the most part. These songs start to if I don't try for any period of time, they damn well just write themselves in my head and sort of fall out. And if anything, the idea of actively trying to write songs is a bit strange to me. And I've only sort of tried to get my head around that in the last couple of years. And particularly during the early stages of lockdown, I almost took it as a challenge to actually write songs and to write songs about the this period in history. So that was kind of strange to me. Yeah, but for the most part, I almost feel like I almost feel like a bit of a fraud, really, because the, you know, a lot of the time I don't feel like I'm particularly in command of the songwriting process. It sort of happens despite me, rather than me sort of guiding it. It just sort of, I appear to have a verse and a chorus in the back of my head somewhere, and you sort of drag them out and learn how to play them on a piano.
I'm nodding and smiling a lot because this theme comes up so much in this series. All the songwriters I'm talking to have a very slightly different way of putting it. So Thea Gilmore said that her songs just fall out of her. Miles Hunt was talking about the idea of being a conduit for the songs, that kind of thing. I love all of this because I feel the same. And I feel like it must be such an annoying thing for some people to hear, someone who wants to write a song, to hear that we're just like, oh yeah, it just happens. I don't know. It's not untrue though.
Yeah, I mean, it almost certainly isn't the case. I mean, this is probably just how it feels. But in actual fact, that this comes about as the result of a great deal of experience. You spend years obsessing over songs and almost like interpreting the world you live in almost like in a musical sense. So you, by the time you've written, you know, 100, 200 songs, whatever, you find that you almost, there's a constant soundtrack in the back of your head, and you interpret events as they happen, almost in a musical and a lyrical way. And even hearing conversations around you, you sort of latch on to certain little expressions or turns of phrase that are just interesting, and you know you might just latch onto it and store it for later. Yeah, I find myself often just overhearing bits of conversation, and just the way that these words are put together just sounds so musical, and there's like a deeper meaning to it, and so you remember that, and then you try and tease out the deeper meaning from it, and so I suppose there is a very active part of you, but a lot of it's sort of happening in somewhere between the conscious and subconscious, where you remember to consider the significance of a moment or a sound or a line or a melody, and then you just let it sit in your brain and fester and stew into until the time is right to actually, you know, sit down with a pen and paper and work out what the hell you think this means.
For me, a big turning point with all of this was deciding that even just internally, I would call myself a songwriter. So I would admit I am a songwriter. I write songs. Mm. It's okay to use that word. I think I'd probably written two albums by this point. Of course, right. I was a songwriter. I write songs, and I had been writing songs for a long time before that. But for some reason, I needed that word or that permission I gave myself. And then now it's like, well, I'm a songwriter. Of course, I'm going to steal words off someone, or like, you know, don't say anything to me you don't want to go in a song, or you know, don't do anything terrible because it's probably going to go in a song or whatever. And just, and then I think, giving myself that permission made a big difference to being able to just really fully embrace that part of me.
Interesting.
And then write more songs.
I'd never even sort of considered the classification of it. I think I probably, it's one of the things I don't really even think about what I am and that stuff, because I'm probably wrong. I'm probably something else. Like, you know, I write songs, but I also, you know, I also fancy myself as a carpenter. So, you know, what can you do?
Yeah. Well, we don't have to be one thing, of course, but sometimes the word can help. And sometimes it's like, sometimes the word does need to come before the thing so that you can do it. Was there a moment where you remember introducing yourself to someone as a musician for the first time?
No, I don't know that I ever do that. It still feels like an odd word. I still don't really think that I'm a musician. Because I know musicians and they're different. Like for me, I struggle through on a variety of different instruments without really having mastered none of them. Mm. You know, I still consider myself to be like an enthusiastic amateur across a wide range of fields, which is how I like to do it. But yeah, so I don't know why I'd even say that I was. I must surely have an answer when people ask what I do. Usually, I mean, I always used to give this really annoying answer. People say, "What do you do?" And I'd say, "Oh, as little as I can get away with," or something god awful like that. But or you go for the like inflated ego answer. I'm an international recording artist, which
that's good.
Or you know, I sing songs. That's
enough.
Yeah, that's what my little girl. She's four. Like when people say, "What does your dad do?" She says he sings songs. So, but then that's just what I do around the house with her. And at some point it's going to come really confusing for her. It's like, well, I don't understand. It's like you sing like songs from Frozen to me, and then somehow, you know, that's your job. Like, can we all just like do nonsense things around the house and that be our job?
That sounds ideal.
Yeah.
When people used to ask me what I do, when I say used to, because I used to meet people and they would ask me what I do, I'd say musician. And most of the time they'd go, "Wow, you're a magician." I'm like, do I not enunciate properly? Or can you just not believe that I would be playing music as my job?
Maybe you're just far more, you know, convincing as a magician.
Perhaps.
You do have something of the mystery and wonder about you. So maybe.
There you go. Thank you, I think. Yeah.
Do you own a top hat?
I don't, but I could. I think that's within reach, isn't it? It's within reach
of
anyone.
I think you could pull it off.
Literally.
Yeah. I actually bought a top hat a while back. Yeah. I am a hat wearer for the most part. Like it's become like a stage, almost like a uniform thing. Like never sing songs not wearing a hat. But I could never bring myself to wear the top hat. It's just too awful. And also, Slash got there first and, you know, sort of trademarked that thing. But yeah.
Ruined that for everyone, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
How do you feel about your early work? Because when you've been releasing albums as long as you have, it would be perfectly reasonable to think, you know, some of them don't sound like you now because you would have grown up so much since then. I've only been releasing albums for 10 years and I have fond feelings for my first one at the moment, but I've no idea what I'm going to feel like in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. about that one?
You know, I'm very fond of everything I've ever done. Mm-hmm. You know, much as a father is fond of their kids, you know. Mm-hmm. But I definitely think it depends how far back we're going. If we're going back to like my Easy World records with my old band, I would say I really, really don't like our first album, or indeed like mm-hmm. the mini album that came out before then. You know, I mean, I was too old to be that kind of green and immature. I think I was 21, 22, but like it sounds like, you know, an early teenage, you know,
okay.
naive, not really knowing what I was doing, a bunch of recordings. And yeah, you've got to grow up sometime. And you know, I'm sure it wasn't that bad, but like I don't feel particularly proud of that work. I think by the time we made our second album, I think that's a really interesting record. And I think it's got some very ambitious and I don't want to say impressive, but you know, some interesting and ambitious things on it. And then like all my solo work, I'm very fond of, and I wouldn't like to use the word proud, but I think there's, you know, I think it all, I think it all does me credit.
Good.
Shall we say? I feel a great sense of sort of ownership and warm affection to all of it. Even my very, very difficult second album, which in many ways, like how difficult it was to make, is part of the reason that I like it as much as I do.
Hmm. Why was that difficult?
Well, it's the only solo record I've ever made with the help of a record label.
Ah.
And that wasn't in and of itself what was difficult about it. I went about it very completely wrong. Like I'd made a first album that was essentially like home demos that I'd made myself, never expecting it to be a record. And then those demos got picked up, and for a minute there was a genuine like bidding war for the rights to my first album, like in, you know, across the Atlantic. Like it was very, very strange to be involved with, and so there was a lot of expectation on my second album. And so what was decided was that I would produce it myself in the same way that we'd done the first one, but I wanted to be a lot more ambitious sonically in a production sense. And so essentially I just overreached enormously. And I went too, you know, it was too ambitious, and I didn't have the skills to actually pull it off, and I didn't have the understanding to know that I didn't have the skills. And so essentially what I delivered to the label, they rejected. And I'd essentially never suffered rejection as an artist ever in my life before.
Oh no.
And it absolutely destroyed me. Like I had an actual nervous breakdown, like and like a proper actual debilitating depression that lasted, you know, years. But at the same time, you know, we had to get the record finished. And so it's so weird. It seems really dumb to even say that now, that something is as trivial as that. Like today I could deliver a record to a label today and have them reject it and just not give a shit. But like, but then, you know, I was so sort of serious and earnest, and I felt like I'd done some really good work, and that it was sort of audacious and ambitious and impressive. And I thought this is exactly what I want to be doing. And I didn't think I was that far off it being good. And then to be told that like, you have fucked this and we are not putting this record out, it's like, it absolutely destroyed me. Yeah. Silly though that seems, but you know, but that's the truth of it. That was a very difficult record to make thereafter, because at that point I was not only trying to salvage something from the wreckage of the record that I'd made, but also like my brain was in a mess. So I just couldn't, I couldn't really work very effectively.
Looking back, do you think that they were right about the record not being the right record or whatever? You know, that's their opinion.
Yeah. They were right and also wrong. I think they were right in the sense that it wasn't the record that they thought they were ever going to get. But they were wrong in the sense that I was never that guy they thought I was. Like, I think they thought that I would follow up this strange, quirky... Because my first album is weird as hell.
Well, the first single is super weird. I've got questions about that as well, because it has no chorus.
Yeah.
Like, how gigantic must your balls be to put out a first single as a solo performer after being in a band that did pretty well by anyone's standards with no chorus? That's brilliant.
It's got no chorus. It's 6.5 minutes long. It's incredibly slow. It's in 6/8 time. Like, everything about it's wrong. It's got two shits and a fuck in it, in the lyrics. Yeah. It's like, it's everything that you don't do. And I think this was one of the things that I think was that made my first album kind of so successful, you know, not commercially, but like in a weird way, it was a big sort of springboard for me. It's like the recordings are so bad, like they're really badly recorded. And like every decision is wrong on there. Like the songs that were singles, they're both over 6 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both really, really slow. And they, like, there's no way that like a producer would allow that to happen, because there was no producer. That's just how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the recordings are, you know, oddly compelling. They're not good, but they're weird. And I honestly think part of the reason that people responded so well to my first album, because it just doesn't sound like anything else. Because no one would be stupid enough to make a record that sounds like that. It's these are errors, you know, these are mistakes. These are bad decisions. But, you know, if you make enough bad decisions and you make them consistently badly, it becomes a thing, you know?
Yeah, this becomes your thing. It sounds like you.
Yeah.
I think that's the stuff that people, that really resonates with people, is something that sounds like the person who made it.
Yeah.
No bullshit. It just sounds like you.
Yeah.
That single, State of the Union, is an amazing song. Amazing song. And I can't figure out why. And it's not like I can't deconstruct people's songs and figure out what makes them work technically anyway. And I wouldn't wish to do so, because I think that sucks the joy out of life. But I have listened to it a lot, just going, why is this so great? Because it really is. Because it's just interesting to me. Going back, I don't want to dwell too much on that really bad part of your life in a horrible journalistic fashion at all.
You can if you like. I've absolutely made peace with it. Like,
okay, I'm glad. But it's interesting, because I'm not suggesting that all artists are always right, but it's also all labels are not always right. And I suppose the point is that going into a partnership with anyone like that as an artist, I suppose an understanding of what they want, what they're paying you to do in some sense, and whether you're willing to accept that as a trade-off for, you know, giving up that independence of creativity. Is that something you even considered when they came along and wanted to make that record with you, or to sort of fund it or what have you?
No, because one of the things that was promised was, you know, artistic independence,
right.
Which of course that isn't how it unfolded. It was a strange way of dealing with me that they had, which was like, we don't want to get involved in the creative process and tell you what to do, but we're not putting this shit out, you know. It was like that. Like, go away and do something, anything, do whatever you feel like doing, just don't give me this shit back again,
right?
You know, it was even a fight when the record was finally made. Just choosing the track list, I remember quite vividly, like, I knew what order I wanted the songs to be in, and I was very particular about it, because for me that is the order of the songs on the record. This is the record and this is how it should be.
Yeah.
And the fellow at the label was like, no, that's not, you know, we need to put the singles at the front and, you know, do whatever you want at the end, don't care, but we need all the big songs need to be at the beginning. I was like, why is that important? And it got to this point of this very strange standoff. He was saying, I would never tell you what to do. It's entirely up to you, but we have to do it this way.
Yeah.
And I think, well, that's wrong. Like, I'm telling you as the artist, like, give me this, please, after everything, give me this. And he was like, the record will not come out in that order.
And we all know the reason for that is to do with buyers, record shop buyers, isn't it? In the old days, you'd have all the bangers, all the singles, whatever, all the radio things they've decided at the beginning of the album so that when they send it out to people who buy records to go into record shops, again, I think this is the old system, I don't know if it's changed now, then if they just skip through the first few, they can decide. That's, I think that's all it's for. It's nothing to do with art. It's nothing to do with communicating your stories to the listener.
I understand this, but like, has any record, and obviously there's no way of knowing this, but has any record like not achieved what it could have just based purely on that nonsense, you know?
The people who make those rules up must think they're so important that they're so important that they're going to have a standoff with you about the track listing of your own record.
Yeah.
Right? Because that guy, we do it this way. Why? No reason. We just do.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
It was from beginning to end, that record was a fucking nightmare. I should say from beginning, the beginning part was lovely. I went off and made what I thought was a great record. And then, yeah, the second half of it got pretty dark pretty quick.
Have you ever done a director's cut of that record? Put it back.
Yeah, I did it recently, actually.
Oh, good.
That was one of my lockdown projects. Was I decided to do a live gig from here in my garage. I was doing two a month to start with, but I sort of slowed down a bit after that. Mm-hmm. And I was doing themed shows, and one of them was just playing songs from my second album, and as like an accompanying, you know, souvenir, I went back to not all of them, but some of the original recordings, and I just mixed them, finished them off. I didn't record anything new. That was like the rules. Mm. It was almost like, you know, for myself, as some kind of closure. If I go back and just take what was there, like how bad was it? If I just had an expert, not that I'm an expert now, but you know, I'm certainly have more expertise now than I did then.
Yeah.
To just sort of, you know, tweak some things and mix it and balance it and put it out, and it's like, I ended up thinking, this is good. This is a good record. It would have been okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, but again, I wasn't in a position to sort of see wood for trees and go, I'll just, you know, hook up with a good mix engineer and we'll just get this to the line.
Yeah. That can really do a number on you though. I'm so glad you did go back and listen and you feel better about that stuff now, because you could spend the rest of your life going, yeah, that second album was shit because that person thought it was wrong or whatever. Mm. But it's not based in reality. It's based in their reality. And for them, it's not that they're wrong. It's not that they're trying to be evil to you and gaslight you. It's just that they have a different expectation, like you were saying. They wanted to hear something different from you.
Yeah.
But that's not really how it works. So I'm really glad you got to reclaim it, because it's yours in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it was very interesting. I can't believe how bad it wasn't when I actually went back.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah. It's a lot of water under the bridge now. To be honest, I think everyone involved could have handled it a lot better.
Mm.
I think everybody, without exception, did some of their weakest work on that record, and you know, not sort of artistically, creatively, but sort of as far as just interpersonally, I think that really is the, you know, one of the most difficult things to establish when you do work with other people is just how to deal with each other in difficult times, which was kind of weird, because I up until that point I had a very, very good relationship with my label, and sort of continued to afterwards, but that whole situation was just handled kind of poorly across the board.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, you know, we move on.
Yeah. Do you think of it as a useful lesson in any way? Have you taken anything positive from that in your life as you progressed onwards?
Definitely. I think it's definitely given me a much more not blasé, because I would never say that, but I think I'm much happier at accepting criticism. I mean, that said, that's actually the last record I've ever made with the assistance of a record label. Like everything I've done since then has been made entirely independently. Even if it's been released on a label, it's always the actual creative process has always been on my own, and has always been very smooth, and you know, I think the results have been fine. So maybe I'm just, you know, cut out to be a more of a lone wolf figure. But I think, you know, I've learned a lot about the actual nuts and bolts of making records through that experience. Yeah. And I've also definitely learned a lot about kind of myself and my limitations, and learned to maybe, while taking it seriously, not taking it so personally, I think.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I can't say I'm someone who invites criticism of my work before I've released it. I don't really much care for it after it's out either, because it's not useful, because it's done then.
Yeah.
But so I really relate to what you're saying. And yeah, the more records I make, the fewer people I seem to be working with on them, because I produce my own stuff anyway.
Yeah.
But this last one I've just finished, I engineered the whole thing in this room, and I have an incredible mix engineer who I know I can send stuff to him, and he'll just do an incredible job. And then that's it, really. Like, I don't know. I just can't imagine a conversation with someone where I'm like, I don't know how this should go. You tell me. You know, I just know how it goes, and I do it, and I'm not pretending that it's the very best that song could ever possibly be. I'm not getting 25 other writers in to make it the very best pop song or whatever it is. It's just that the songs are what they are, and I make them, and then they go out, and then that's it. And even when it comes to, we're talking about sort of promoting music earlier and how much of a nightmare that is, I fail to see the point of reviews these days, because you can listen to the music. You don't necessarily need someone to describe what's happening in the music. If someone can write so beautifully about how it makes them feel or something, that's great. But sort of like pointing out what you think the artist has done wrong, or what you thought they were trying to achieve but they didn't, based on nothing, I find that to be so pointless. But there are a few really good music writers out there now, and I've just sort of started noticing a few online writers who are really good. But for the most part, I find that to be so pointless. How do you feel about that stuff, about reviews and promotion and all that, given that you really just want to make songs and not put them out?
I certainly don't think the last few records that I've made have been reviewed, because I didn't do any press for them, so I didn't. Because the thing is, like, I think people out in the world presume that, like, every time a record is made, that everybody, every radio DJ is aware of it, and every press is aware of it, and they will write about it. It's like, no, if you don't pay someone to tell the radio stations to play something, it doesn't get played. Mm-hmm. And even if you do pay them to tell the radio station to play something, it almost certainly doesn't get played. And if you don't pay someone to do your PR, then the newspapers do not know that or care that you've made a record. It's like,
yes. And again, even if you do, they don't really care.
Yeah. So I'm not aware that I've had a review for the last 10 years. I think every now and then, you know, there will be something. Like, my former manager used to know a couple of people at radio and a couple of people at press. And so every time I had a record out, he'd just send it to them and send it to them, and a review would appear, and it would often be a very nice one. And I don't know if that's because they actually like the record, or because of, you know, some pre-existing friendship thing. And you never really do know these things. There's a lot of you don't necessarily know the reasons why some things are reviewed well or poorly. Yeah. There's probably more to it than that. And in the end, who really, really cares?
Yeah. I suppose that the reason that people get pulled into doing it, of course I'm talking about myself here,
of course,
is because there's this little dream that, oh, okay, I've made these songs and I feel hopeful that they can go out into the world and do something to, you know, bring more people into my ecosystem, so that when I play gigs, there'll be more people there. You know, that kind of, you know, just general organic growth, but coming in from, you know, entry points, which would be singles, videos, reviews, whatever. But of course, knowing that you have to pay to be in that game is one matter. I really respect the fact that you have chosen to opt out of it, because I've often chosen to opt out of it. And then at the last minute, I go, oh, but am I really giving these songs the best start in life if I'm not, you know, ticking all the boxes of the things to give them that best start, which includes PR, potentially.
Yeah.
But it's always been such a disappointment for me. You do not get the return on what you spend. It seems like a fool's errand to me. And it seems like, yeah, there's so much more going on than even just paying for even a really good PR company to do stuff for you. It doesn't guarantee anything, of course, nor should it. But, you know, it doesn't. So it just seems like a real waste of money. And also just a waste of hope, because the hope that, oh, one day maybe I'll get a great review of this record, which will bring in hundreds or thousands of people to listen to it. And then, you know, we get to grow the community and all this stuff. That's the dream. It's a good dream. It's an honest dream of mine. It's not like I'm trying to trample over anybody else. But when I hear people are just like, no, I'm not doing it, I'm just like, I want to have that conviction, I think. So where did that come from for you?
Just ignorance. Like I never did that. I don't know how to do it. Like, I don't know. I wouldn't know how to get someone to do my PR. Like, I don't know anyone who does it. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Like, do you just like Google PR firm and then just like find that one and then go, hello, can you promote my record? I don't know how to do it. So I just don't do it. I mean, it is just ignorance. And
but it sounds like you've got some ethics around it as well, though, and like, because you're not pandering to the industry and stuff.
It's more just the laziness and the ignorance. Yeah, I think, like, but also that's just not, it's not anything I know or I'm good at, and it's not something I really want to get good at. Like, I don't care enough, really.
Yeah,
I mean, but again, this is coming from a position of, you know, I back when I was putting records out with labels and stuff, I did get reviews and, like, you know, double page spreads in national newspapers and things, and like it didn't change a thing, you know. It didn't really, as far as we could tell, didn't change anything.
So how are you in touch with the people that you've gathered over the years? Do you have a mailing list?
I think so.
I'm just wondering, when you put records out, how do people hear about them if you're not so you're not doing press, you're not doing radio? That's the thing.
Yeah, and I'm not doing social media either. So
just pigeons flying through the air with your name on them or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, I do a sort of a perfunctory, you know, so I will occasionally have sort of bouts of writing things on Twitter, and if anything's happening, I'll write something on Facebook, like, you know, if there's a gig or a record coming out.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. I think I do have a mailing list that, you know, I'm not in touch with regularly, but I think if I've got a record out, then I think there is a way I can write to everyone. And then you just hope that everyone tells everyone else, and that it goes that way. And I know, and look, I know it sounds idiotic, because, like, I know that I'm not reaching as many people as I could. Like, that's a given. It's a fact, but it's a fact that I am. You know, I'm happy to take on the chin.
Yeah.
And it still seems to be sort of ticking over, even paying such scant attention to the mechanics of my career as I do. There still appears to sort of be one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's shrinking, and that, you know, I probably this time next year, you know, I'll be working at B&Q or something.
A noble profession, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, I really need to up my hardware game anyway, so I think that in itself will be an interesting diversion.
I hope there are musicians listening, and I hope that anyone who's really worrying about, am I using Facebook enough, am I posting enough on Instagram, am I whatever, can see an alternative, because I know that there is an alternative.
Yeah,
you're one example of that. There are lots of people who are having really thriving careers who aren't doing that stuff all day long. That stuff's a distraction, it's entertainment, it's not the core thing that we do as artists, obviously. And so I think it's just really good to have that demonstrated, you know. There are other ways.
Yeah, there are. And I actually think that if you can get into a position where the thing you care about and the only thing that you consider to be important is how you value your work, you know, the artistic product that you make, then you can't lose, and there is no disappointment. The only disappointment is if you don't feel like you've made something as good as you can. And for me, I think every hour that you spend trying to be a better marketing person, that's an hour you didn't spend bettering your art and your craft. And obviously, it's, you know, it's not as binary as that. It's not like you either do this or you do that. And I should point out, there are some people, you know, I'm absolutely not saying that if you're a musician who's active on social media, that you're a filthy sellout. Like, there are some people who can balance the two really well, and who can actually use their interaction with their audience as a, as a creative impetus. If that's just not me, like for mm-hmm. me, it's always been a, you know, a solitary pursuit. And actually the fewer voices inside my head while I'm trying to be creative, the better. So I want everyone to leave me the hell alone and let me get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when there's a record, you can hear that, but like, we don't need to be talking all the time.
No, you're right. You're right. I'm a bit in the middle because I really enjoy the social media stuff. If I can keep a lid on my time spent on it, I really enjoy it. And there's something really lovely about that as a sort of another puzzle. So the music's one puzzle, like how to get it to people's another puzzle. But I think what you're saying is so true, that if it's something that you don't enjoy or you don't feel good at, or it doesn't fit with your values or how you're trying to live your life, don't feel you have to do it. Mm. I think that's the worst thing when I hear musicians, you know, talking about how they're worried that they're not doing Instagram enough. It's like, well, just do it enough that you're happy with what you did and then move on. And like you say, the art has to be so interesting and good that, one, you love it for as long as possible, and you can look back fondly on your back catalogue, and two, that people will actually share it with each other, because it's not our job to share it hand to hand, you know, with everyone. It's our job to make something so compelling that people will share it with each other, ideally.
Exactly. That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
When I'm at my most arrogant and I'm asked, what's the best thing to do to, you know, better your career in music, I just say, be really fucking good at it.
Yeah.
You know, it's be better, work harder at the thing that, you know, be really good at making music, write better songs. But it's so rare that anyone says that.
Yeah.
Whenever I do get sort of, you know, it's usually like, you know, young kids in bands will come up to me at shows and they'll be like, what advice could you give us? Like, you know, PR or, you know, social media, or like, how do you, you know, do this thing I've never heard of? No one ever comes up to me and says, how do you write better songs? Or like, what, you know?
Yeah. But that's too hard.
Yeah.
People want the easy answer, even when they're asking, because they ask me a lot about social media stuff as well. I used to be super into it. I'm not into it now. I wouldn't say that I'm not quite a digital minimalist, but I'm going in that direction. It used to be, I would say, an obsession for me. And I got really good at it. And it's been really effective in a world where there's little else to help us, to be honest. So, you know, I really doubled down on that. And then just recently, over the past 2 or 3 years, I've been really stepping away. Because I just don't think it's the way I want to live my life ongoing. Because for me, a lot of the last 10 years have been trying to get to a point where I could do my music full time, which has now happened. And then not really thinking about what the next bit was. And then I started thinking about, well, what is the next bit? I've achieved this goal. Hopefully I can keep this thing going as it is, because I really love doing it like this. But then, do I want to be spending 20 hours a week on Twitter? No, I do not. How much time a week would I like to be spending making new music? Well, this much, you know, and starting to plan it out that way. Because I never had a plan for success. If it all went well, what's my ideal life setup, I suppose? And so that's made me think about that a lot. But yeah, when people ask me about that, even about social media and things you can track and whatever, they still want an easy answer. Because they don't want me to say, work really hard, spend lots of time on it, do this, read a load of books. They go, oh, okay. We were hoping there'd be just like a red button you could press, or you pay £500 to this random person who emails you out of the blue, and then it's done. But that's not how anything works.
But I think a lot of that comes from this idea that what they're actually saying to you is like, I am already brilliant and I'm wonderful and I don't need to improve. But how do I get my brilliance to the rest of the world? And I think that's, if that is actually how you think, then you're almost certainly wrong. I mean, maybe they are brilliant and they do just need to get an audience. But the idea that they don't feel that what's required is a gradual improvement of their skill set is.
And it is very annoying to have someone go, just write really good songs, because that's annoying. But I mean, you know, you're being annoying when you say that, because that's really annoying.
I know I'm being annoying when I say everything that comes out of my mouth. It's the reason to live, quite frankly, which is why I talk to so few people.
Well, I'm very honoured.
Well, so was I. It's like, oh my God, here's someone I can annoy for an hour and a half.
And I'll just control alt delete the entire thing.
Yeah.
Because I have that power. No, I'm not going to do that. So on the subject of the internet, how has it impacted your career over the last 20 years, would you say?
That's an interesting question. I I don't know, really. I mean, I'm sure it has impacted my career in that sort of everything happens very differently now. The first record I made would have been in a time before, you know, YouTube and iTunes and certainly Spotify and even maybe Napster. I don't know. But so the internet and music weren't nearly as sort of knitted together as they are now. It was still very much about, you know, physical records in physical shops.
Yeah.
And so obviously it's been an evolving situation up to the point now where everything's online, and I've just sort of been carried along with that tide, really. So I mean, it's just changing all those ways, you know, in the way that we release music is different now, and I can't say that I'm particularly. That I really care one way or the other.
Yeah,
I liked the old-fashioned physical record shop model, but it's just not suitable for the modern age. So, you know, I'm not gonna be one of these people who says, "Oh, the internet's ruined music." In some ways, it's made it a lot more democratic. But democracy isn't all it's cracked up to be. It sometimes yields some pretty unpleasant results. I've not really given a huge amount of thought, to be honest with you. Like it's different now. That has happened, and that's how it is. And you know, for me, my relationship with the internet is still a kind of an arm's length one. Like I'm not that interested in the internet, and I don't use it nearly as much as other people do. You know, largely because I do feel like I am from a generation before. You know, the internet generation, like I'm still a bit of a dinosaur, and I just didn't really adopt it in that way. So yeah, it's changed a lot in how my music comes out, and I don't really have an opinion, I'm afraid.
It's pretty handy for putting your own records out, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I'm sure if it weren't for the ability to put music online, I very probably couldn't sustainably still make records. So in that respect, you know, it's a good thing. However, given that it has sort of replaced the old record industry model, which I have a fondness for, to be honest, I think I do find myself being a little nostalgic for the old days where you would, you know, like gigs in London, there'd always be like a murky cabal of A&R men at the back of the room if you got it right. And then like it actually happened for my band. We played a gig and there was a scout from a label there who said, "Hey, you guys are good." And then the next time we did a gig in London, he brought his boss and then they signed us, and that was it. And I think there's something so romantic and exciting about that, way more than there is about, okay, well, if you can get your social media hits up and if you can get your, you know, your Spotify streams to this number, then we can get someone to take a look at you.
Yeah. If you can do all of our work for us first.
Exactly, yeah.
And prove you have an audience who will pay to come and see you, then we'll happily take a percentage of that money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have this nostalgic feeling towards the pre-internet days. And back to the days when, as I said at the very beginning of our conversation, like a label would come along, take a chance on you, give you an amount of money, often which you could live off for, you know, a year or two, and they would ask you to just be an artist and then say, "We'll take care of everything else." And maybe they'd do it badly and maybe they wouldn't do a terribly good job, but it was just being given the permission to not think about it, which is I think something that I think might be beneficial to people who are artistically inclined to not have to think about promotion. Because I think when artists are also doing the promoting, my concern is that the promotional marketing element starts to invade the creative element of what they do. And you end up trying to make records for the marketplace rather than for, you know, the beautiful innocence of creation.
Yeah, and making fewer records probably, because it's so much easier. Like your brain can handle going on your phone, scrolly, 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 click, 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 likes on here. I've done stuff today.
Yeah.
And your brain's always trying to, well, not your brain, one's brain is always trying to avoid the creative, you know, puzzle ahead of you, because that's hard and scary, and it's about you, and it's about like facing your fears and things. And it's not really hard because it's the best thing in the world. Like, yeah. For me, it's the most fun thing to do. But it can take me an awfully long time to get started on being creative in a day. Whereas it's very easy to go, oh, I'll just check my emails and I'll tap this reply to this person and sort this stuff out. That's easier. Like, your brain can organize it. So
yeah,
I think cutting down on the time away from that is really important. Yeah.
Or the flip side is you end up making more music, because this is the thing. It's like, it's product. You've got to get content out there, content into the world. And so you just like anything, it doesn't matter what it is, just everything has to be churned out.
I'm not into that.
Yeah. And I think probably the way that we make records, where you're actually kind of, I'm guessing you're not such an in the box kind of producer. As in, like, you actually have like microphones and instruments and stuff.
Oh yeah.
I mean, and that takes time, you know, and it's not something where you can, you know, have a finished track in an hour, which, you know, in some other musical forms and styles, you genuinely can do that. Like, let's drop a beat in here, and let's like throw a bass line on there, and then that's just like, you know,
yeah.
There we go. Song's finished, and that, you know, right. Let's do another one, and you can make a whole record really quickly. And if that's how you work, you can be making, you know, 5 albums in a year easily.
Wow.
And
yeah.
content, and then you're doing all your social media at the same time, and you find that, you know, when you have 1,000 albums on Spotify, that really helps to get your numbers up.
Well, that's what we've been told to do as well, isn't it? By the head of Spotify recently. He was saying a bunch of nonsense about that. Just churn out more content, guys. And my problem with that was, one, I don't have the energy to engage with this. And two, listeners only have one set of ears and they can only listen so much. So if I was making 5 albums a year, I'm now expecting my audience to listen to 5 times as much music a year to help me out, which is like ridiculous. So...
But also my problem, I don't have a huge problem with Spotify in the way that, you know, artists are supposed to, like, because they don't pay you very well. Like, it's true, they don't. But but for me, I'm not that crazy about what it means for the job that music does in people's lives. It means that I feel like people listen in a much less discriminatory way. And I mean discriminatory in, not in the negative sense, you know, like, as in, you know, discriminating between things that are good and things that aren't good. I think there's much more of a this idea that you just put stuff on in the background and sort of listen to it passively, rather than in a way that you're engaged, and then you play a song and then something else comes on. And I don't know, I feel like the idea, but particularly when artists, and I use that term broadly, are encouraged to put so much content out there for the benefit of their career, essentially what you're doing is you're muddying the soundscape for the people listening. I think put out less, but put out stuff that's good is ultimately for the benefit of the listener. But because it's to the detriment of the career artist, then we go in a different direction. And I just think it ultimately isn't beneficial for popular music and song as an art form. I think ultimately it can only damage, you know, the general landscape.
That's so wise. I'm just going to take that in. That's a really interesting perspective on it. I agree. I definitely agree. I have this idea of wanting to make an album every year, because I want to keep making lots of music. But I know that really it's only going to be every year and a half, 2 years, because I'm very overambitious with my time at the best of times. So it's definitely not going to be one a year. And I have this aim, like I want to have made at least 20 albums and then just keep making them. But I don't know why I have these numbers in my head. Probably because my brain likes to go, oh yes, a number I can reach for, not a more intangible goal, because they're a bit more scary. But yeah, certainly churning out content is not what this life is about.
No,
at all.
No, and again, you know, I try to, I try to not be terribly binary in my thinking, like even though I do think that is the case, but I have to try and remember that there are probably some people who can churn stuff out and churn out good stuff, and for whom this way of thinking really makes sense and does get the best out of them. I can't really imagine who it is and what their stuff is like, but my default status is obnoxious prick, like being very judgmental and opinionated. So I always have to like give my obnoxious opinion and then go, but I'm sure the opposite could also be true. I'm trying to better myself in that regard.
That's good. Well, let's wrap up because I'm sure we could talk about all this all day, but you know, probably got to go and write some brilliant songs or something based around three chords with no chorus. Damn you.
Yeah.
Anyway, I really want to crack what the fuck you did with that song. But
I can tell you if you like.
Yes, please.
Okay, right. So here's what you do. It's ultra repetitive, but it builds. So it's linear, but it's on an upward slope. And okay. I think that's the thing. It doesn't have the rise and the fall. It just goes rise, 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 rise. And so I think what happens is the listener is maybe sort of drawn in because it sort of every couple of times it loops around, something else gets added to the mix sonically, but also lyrically. And it starts off quite sort of, you know, calm. And then by the end, it's just like this noise fest with loads of screaming and shouting in it. But also there's something about the very repetitive where there's a hypnosis about it. And I think if you don't ever cut to the chorus, and because the loop is a very short one, it's, you know, it's only like a 2 or 4 bar loop depending on how big you think a bar is, you're very quickly locked into its repetitiveness. Mm-hmm. And then all you have to do is you have to make sure that the words are interesting, and the words are kind of like angry, but they're sort of vague, and like every now and then it's like, oh, I think you're talking about politics there, and then like, oh, now he said fuck, isn't this getting interesting. And, you know, easy, cheap tricks. But State of the Union was a very odd song because I didn't think about any of those things when it was being written. It just sort of happened that way.
Yeah.
And I just very surprised how it engaged with people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only reason that I've ever had a career as a soloist was that song.
Wow.
That was the one that got labels interested, that got opened up America, and you know, if I hadn't recorded that song and made the video for it, then you know, it would have been over like on that first record.
Right. So when I'm writing a song, even if it could be the weirdest thing in the world to anyone else, but I know I've got enough creative energy to just see through this idea. I don't spend a lot of time going, oh, should it go like this? Or, oh, but what if I did this? Then it would be better. It's not like that. I just know how it's supposed to go incrementally. It's like a collage of stuff I do, and then it's done. Is that how it works for you? Or how did that song come together? Do you remember?
If pretty much every record I make, there'll be one song that is in a similar format. It'll be very repetitive and it will build, and it will essentially just be like verse, 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 verse. Yeah. And normally there'll be the angry songs, and I'll write them very quickly, the lyrics, and I'll have an idea for a verse, and I'll sit down and I'll write down the idea that I had. And then there'll just be another one that will lead into that. And they're usually songs where the, you know, it's almost, and I hate to even suggest it, but it almost feels like almost like a rap thing. Like it's a rhythmical thing, and the rhythm informs the meter, which informs the language. And it becomes a very instinctive, very quick thing to write. Essentially, I will write pages and pages and pages and pages of verses, and then look at it and kind of sometimes literally chop it up with scissors and put it all together. But often it's having the, I don't know if confidence is the right word. It could be laziness to kind of go, we don't need a chorus, just verse, 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 verse. And if you sort of sculpt the rise and sometimes falls, you know, carefully enough, and make sure that the words are telling the story that you want to tell and conveying the intensity that you want to convey, then in some ways that like the last thing you want to do is break off into a chorus. You just want to like just keep people on the hook for as long as possible, and then just end, just get rid of it. But and I I understand that it's a strange songwriting form to just write, you know, verse. Mm. But I know it just seems to be something that I do and have developed a certain affinity with that form and an understanding of how to do it in a tasteful way.
I'm going to do that as a songwriting challenge, I think, because I've never done a song with just verses in it. Never. I've done really weird arrangements, but I've never done that one. I'm going to do that.
I've done verse songs. I think one of the things that, and it didn't necessarily come first, but because my live thing's been based around a loop machine for a long, long time, songs without choruses are just so much easier to loop up.
Yeah, yeah. Independently of me having supported your band a really long time ago and not really probably talked to anyone in the band because no one did then, weirdly. Yeah. People started telling me about you because I do looping as well. And so when people saw that I did looping in my live set, they would say, oh, have you heard David Ford? He's amazing. And I looked you up and I listened. I was like, yeah, really like this music. I didn't connect the two bands or the two projects at all till, you know, not that long ago, actually. So yeah, your renown as a looper has reached me through many people because everyone loves telling me how great you are. And I'm like, are you saying I'm not good or are you saying that I will also like him?
I used to get that a lot. Like I do what I think is like, I did the loop performance of my life and someone comes up to me afterwards. Oh, do you know, you remind me of so-and-so. They're so good at that thing that you just did.
Like, that you're trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah. My trick with the looping is mostly to do it as an outro. The chorus out or something, and then it's like, you know, not to ruin the magic for anyone listening, but that's then you don't have to switch to anything else because it's just keeping going. Just giving you a tip there, because you know you could always improve, couldn't you?
I'll take it wherever I can. Thank you
You're
very much.
Welcome. Now, just to finish off, I'd love to know which three pieces of your own work you would recommend for listeners of this podcast to listen to you and get into your musical world.
Oh my goodness, what a horrible question.
I know, I'm horrible.
Laura, you're killing me. There's a song of mine called Every Time, which is on an album called Charge. And that album is, without realizing it, pretty much all my albums are sort of kind of thematic in some sort of way, even if I don't realize it at the time of making them. And that record is largely about my experience within and without the music industry. And the song Every Time I wrote at the same time as I was writing my book, which outlines my first 10 years of being a singer and a songwriter and deals largely with the very difficult second album that we spoke about before. Mm-hmm. Essentially, I wrote that song as, it's kind of an answer to the people who would come up to me after gigs. And they would often sort of look at me with great sympathy, with these puppy dog eyes and say something like, "Don't worry, son, hang in there. You'll make it one day." which if you think about it, is just a way of saying, "You're kind of a loser, aren't you?"
Well done, audience.
And it always, and I would never know what to say. You kind of go, "Thanks," or you go, "Why don't you fuck off?" You know. but anyway, I was in a very reflective mood when I was making that album and particularly writing that song, and it occurred to me that if I could go back in time and visit. And just tap on the shoulder, the 16-year-old me coming out of the guitar exchange shop in Eastbourne with my first electric guitar under my arm and say, "Do you know what? When you're 40, you are going to like play a sold out gig in New York City playing songs that you've written yourself." You know, there won't be a huge number of people there, but, you know, it'll be 100 people in a room. In America, watching you, I would have said, "Oh my God, that I'm a fucking rock star. That is like that's the only thing I ever could possibly wish is to just do this nonsense for 20 years and not have to, you know, not have to worry about it. Just do it and love it and enjoy it and occasionally be mentally damaged by it, but you know, but keep doing it."
Yeah.
Yeah, so that song is essentially. All those thoughts compressed into what I think is one of my better songs. You want another two after that? Jeez.
Yeah.
I really like my album Let the Hard Times Roll, which is my third solo album. That was the record that helped me to get over the second album. And did the job remarkably well. Like, it was just a joy to make. And that was again sort of on my own, just making records, you know, having learned a great deal. And yeah, it was just an absolute joy to make that album. A real kind, you know, kind of a lifesaver, really, to kind of get back on the horse after being so rudely thrown off it a little bit before. And to make a record, you know, having been dropped by my label in the UK and in the US, and just being completely on my own, and just being so happy, you know, to be free. And, you know, and there was a lot to miss about not being on a label anymore. But it was great to just make a record without any of the baggage and the pressure to do that.
Yeah.
So that one as well. And yeah, I don't know. Read my book. There we go.
Yes.
That'll be the third thing. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a delight.
For more on David and his work, come and visit the show page at penfriend.rocks/David, and you can join my friendly community and get some free songs while you're there. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend, and feel free to say hi on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook. I'm at penfriendrocks everywhere. Gigantic thanks to the members of my Correspondence Club for being the motor behind the making of my music and podcasts. I honestly don't know what I'd have done throughout this pandemic without your support. Thank you for everything. All the music in this podcast appears on my upcoming album, and this song, Exotic Monsters, is my latest single. You can find it wherever you get your music, but the best and most direct way to support this independent artist is by visiting penfriend.rocks/monsters. I'll be back next Wednesday with another deep conversation about creativity, grit, and determination. So I hope to catch you then. Take care.